Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. John Kerry has wrapped up the first visit to Sri Lanka by a U.S. Secretary of State in 43 years. During his trip, he praised Sri Lanka's democratic reforms and said he hopes to broaden bilateral ties with the country. During a Saturday visit to Colombo, Mr. Kerry met with a number of government officials.
The foreign minister and I agreed to establish an annual partnership dialogue between our two governments. I've also asked teams from across our government to mobilize quickly in order to provide technical assistance.
Discussing trade, Secretary Kerry said the U.S. is backing economic integration among countries in the South and Southeast Asia as a way of strengthening local economies. Four more people have been rescued from the rubble days after the devastating earthquake in Nepal. It includes a 101-year-old man. Police said Sunday that the man was found about 80 kilometers northwest of Nepal's capital of Kathmandu. Meanwhile, rescue workers earlier reported three other survivors had been pulled from the debris in a district northeast of Kathmandu. Meanwhile, the death toll could climb much higher than the current total of more than 7,000. Pakistan has urged Afghanistan's Taliban to cease its annual spring offensive and instead engage in peace talks with the Kabul government. The statement to VOA by a top Pakistani official comes as Afghan and Taliban officials, together with other stakeholders, gathered in Qatar for an unofficial dialogue. Representatives of the Taliban-led warring factions, government peace negotiators, and Afghan peace activists are among the delegates in Doha. This is VOA News. Nigeria's military has rescued nearly 700 people in the past week that were kidnapped by Boko Haram in the country's northeast. An official says close to 300 kidnapped victims, mostly children, were brought to a refugee camp in northeastern Nigeria on Saturday. Authorities say they were rescued Thursday in the Sambisa Forest as part of an ongoing operation to free hostages. More than 3,400 migrants were rescued from boats near the coast of Libya Saturday and early today, and more rescue operations were expected during the day as people smugglers took advantage of calm seas, according to Italy's Coast Guard. All of those that were rescued were being brought back to Italy, and some reached Lampedusa, which is Italy's southernmost island, during the night. Others are expected to arrive in Sicily or in southern Italy tonight. Meetings between Syria's warring factions and the UN Syrian envoy began this week. It's the latest bid to kickstart stalled negotiations to end the country's four-year civil war. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura will hold separate in-depth consultations with each of the parties on the dire situation in Syria. UN spokesman Ahmed Fawzi says de Mistura will take stock of their views on reopening peace talks based on the 2012 so-called Geneva communique. One of the points in this accord involves a commitment to form a transitional government. Fawzi tells VOA the list of participants invited is large and all-inclusive. Encompassing. Invitees reportedly include the United States, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. However, Fawzi notes the militant groups Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra have not been invited because they are classified as terrorist organizations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
People around the world today congratulated England's Duke and Duchess of Cambridge on the birth of their new daughter Saturday. This is Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott.
This is a joyous day for the royal family. It's also a great day for Australians because every member of the royal family has a respect, affection and enthusiasm for Australia. We've got Prince Harry serving with the Australian Army just at the moment. That's part of a long tradition by the royal family of engagement with our country, and I'm sure that the new princess will be an enthusiastic participant in that great tradition.
Today is World Press Freedom Day. It's an annual observance established by the United Nations to support and celebrate the fundamental principles of press freedom. The UN says the day is also an occasion to inform citizens of violations of press freedom. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The council sometimes goes ahead to punish without giving room for you to be heard. Allow us to come together and be able to do the regulation by ourselves.
Cameroonian journalists observe World Press Freedom Day today amid an alleged government crackdown.
When somebody is ill, you seek treatment as quickly as possible. When somebody dies, make sure that and we understand that you have needs, when you have cultural requirements.
The head of the UN Ebola Emergency Response Team reaffirms effort to end Ebola before the West African rainy season begins.
The details contained in interviews with alleged victims and witnesses by UN investigators, including one of our staff, last summer, are utterly odious.
And the United Nations denies covering up allegations of sexual abuse of children by French soldiers in the Central African Republic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Cameroonian journalists are observing Press Freedom Day against the backdrop of what they describe as a persistent crackdown on media outlets and journalists. Last year, at least 20 media organizations and journalists were either suspended or barred from the profession. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
The vice president of Cameroon's Communication Council, Peter Esoka, says they suspended the media outlets in line with the main objective of the council, which is to regulate the practice of journalism in Cameroon. He says the decisions were based on media offense complaints filed by Cameroonians.
There is not a single case that we have taken a decision in which the people concerned are not summoned to the council. When a complaint comes to us, we summon the people on whom the complaint has been made to come and explain and probably defend themselves. So we have no discrimination whatsoever. Everybody who is concerned about any sanctions we have given has been summoned to the council for discussion.
Journalist John Ba, president of the Cameroon Anglophone Newspaper Publishers Association, says most of the people who file complaints to the Communications Council are government ministers and state functionaries. He says the media should be allowed to regulate itself.
Sometimes, instead of just giving the opportunity for the various media organs, for the various media professionals who are indicted for one reason or the other to defend themselves appropriately, the council sometimes goes ahead to punish without giving room for you to be heard. Allow us to come together and be able to do the regulation by ourselves.
Journalist Kinin Som of the Post newspaper says the main problem in Cameroon is the proliferation of newspapers, which he says is in no way an indication of press freedom.
We have to go back to the drawing board to even redefine who is a journalist. Some of the journalists who are violating ethics are being protected by politicians. Some of those who are publishing newspapers that don't respect ethics at all are just little birds dancing in the middle of the road while the real drummers are in government. Cameroon needs better journalism than what it has now.
Cameroon has more than 500 newspapers and 100 radio and television stations. Journalists say most of the media outfits were created by the government to give the impression there is press freedom in the country, led by President Paul Biya, the world's sixth longest-serving leader. Reporters Without Borders last year said the high number of summonses and suspensions was a clear indication that Cameroon's Communication Council had taken a tougher line towards journalists and media. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
In South Sudan, owners of newspapers and radio stations say the ongoing conflict has not only curtailed press freedoms but has crippled their businesses. They say those challenges, combined with the high cost of living, including high printing costs, has resulted in significant financial losses and an uncertain future for their businesses. For VOA, Mugumi Davis Ruakarinji files this report from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Alfred Taban, founder and editor-in-chief of the Juba Monitor, says copies of his newspaper have been confiscated twice so far this year. He says in some cases, national security agents have even ordered him not to go to print if the edition contains views from the opposition side.
Actually, 90% comes from adverts. So if we don't print, we lose 90% of our revenue. And of course, if it is confiscated, we even lose more because we lose the revenue and we also lose the printing costs.
Taban says he has lost count of how many times he has been instructed to report to the National Security Office and ordered not to publish his paper. And he says it is nearly impossible to seek legal redress for what has happened to him because usually there is no written order. Reporters Without Borders ranks the performance of countries according to a range of criteria, including media independence, respect for the safety and freedom of journalists, and the enforcement of press freedom laws. In its latest index, South Sudan ranks 125th out of 180 countries, falling 6 spots from its previous ranking. Reporters Without Borders says that is largely due to harassment of news organizations in South Sudan. Josephine Achiro, the director for Radio Bakita, whose station was closed by security agents for 2 months last year, says the station incurred heavy losses during the shutdown and had to lay off half of their staff.
We don't have money to pay ourselves salaries. Then we stayed for almost 6 months without getting salaries, but we are giving the service to the people. So until the administration of Bakita has to run up and down to find some other ways of how to get, to give the staff money at least to transport them here and for the communication.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwei has warned media groups and journalists that they will face harsh punishment if they publish or broadcast interviews with the rebel officials. Last year, military officials also said media organizations should run their security-rated stories by the Office of SPLOA to get their approval before they are published or broadcast. And Taban says that doesn't even take into account the bad economy in South Sudan.
For the readers, many of them cannot really afford the cost of even one newspaper, because now we sell one newspaper for £4, and it used to be just £2. When it was £2, there are a lot of people who were buying the newspaper. But now, very many of the copies are not sold because there are no buyers.
Achiro agrees. For example, she says they used to pay £15 for a reporter's transportation to cover an event. Now they must pay about £40 a day.
It is so serious. It affects even us here. I remember some 2 months back we were in some problems with our news desk whereby the story used not to come as usual. It's like whenever we used to have like 6 or 8 stories in a day, it cut down to like 4 or 5 or sometimes even 3 in a day simply because of the issue of the transport.
Last year, President Salva Kiir signed media laws that were supposed to enforce media freedoms in the country. But Taban and Achiro say those guarantees would not be respected until the war ends and peace returns to South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The acting special representative and head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, or UNMEER, has announced his commitment to stopping the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Peter Graf, however, warned that the timeline for doing so is tight. Graf told me that Ebola has to be eradicated before the beginning of the imminent rainy season, which he says could complicate efforts to tackle the disease.
What we're planning for collectively is to intensify our efforts to make sure that in the basically 10 remaining districts or prefectures, as they're called here in Guinea, that we focus on what still can and needs to be done to get to or very close to zero before the rain set in. That includes making sure that a larger proportion of the cases that we find are coming from so-called contact lists, which requires us to work very closely with the communities and bring in people who understand the culture and understand the traditional practices, sit down with them, discuss with them how can we make sure that when somebody is ill, you seek treatment as quickly as possible. When somebody dies, make sure that, and we understand that you have needs, when you have cultural requirements, you have religious requirements, that we can help you make sure that you meet those requirements and yet you manage to keep your family safe.
You know, Ebola is very contagious, and the rainy season will pose a significant challenge if, you know, it's not completely eradicated. What is the cooperation between UNMEER and these countries that have been affected so far, especially when cases have been quite low for the time being?
Ebola is only contagious at the very end, when people show fever, when people have diarrhea or vomiting, or they're bleeding. So early on, when you are infected, initially you're not infectious. You're only infectious when you are very sick towards the end. You're also very infectious just before and just after you've died. And that's actually the tragedy of this disease, because it touches people in their cultural and religious practices. Now, the real problem of the rainy season is not that Ebola itself becomes more problematic. The two problems are that it gets more difficult for the responders to move around, and secondly, a lot of other diseases start popping up, and especially malaria, which can show similar symptoms. So the disease will be masked by other diseases that are more prevalent. That's one. When it comes to the response, what it means between now and probably 4 weeks from now, maximum, that we properly map out. And again, this is done at prefecture level in Guinea, that this is done at district level in Sierra Leone. We map out in the 10 places left what are within the prefecture or within the district the very small communities that are still problematic. Send in people to work with the communities, make sure that they are engaged and that they're opening up. It also means that we have to make sure that where bodies are found, that the teams are ready to make sure that safe and dignified burials take place the same day. So we need sufficient number of teams properly geographically dispersed to take care of that part of the problem. We need to make sure that if somebody falls ill, a test is done quickly, and that the same day the results are back. And if the result is positive, that the person is admitted immediately in a proper treatment center to get the best possible care and to make sure that the person is isolated from his or her family and loved ones. And in this, what is very important and something we had to learn the hard way together is that whilst we're doing this, we have to make sure that the patient, our client, manages to stay in touch with his or her family, so that the person doesn't disappear, as they say, so that the line of communication remains open, that we demystify the problem of the disease.
What is your message to the countries that are still grappling, although cases have reduced, with the disease?
Well, first of all, and here I speak with a little bit of experience, because in Liberia, as you may know, we are tantalizingly close to be able to declare the country Ebola free. When we were in the same position in Liberia and frustration started to set in, and the responders, the many Liberians that were active and were working so hard to get to zero and have been working on this for months and months and months, and they felt we don't have that final result, we managed to convince them. The leadership in the government managed to convince their healthcare providers, stay the course. You're doing the right thing. Keep at it. Intensify. The numbers are down, but it doesn't mean the work is less.
Graph. Peter Graf is the acting special representative and head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, UNMEER. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. The United Nations denies trying to cover up allegations of sexual abuse of children by French soldiers in the Central African Republic. It says a senior UN official suspected of leaking a confidential report has been suspended for having breached rules aimed at protecting the young victims. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has this report from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is constrained by what it can say because two investigations are underway. UN spokesman Rupert Colville says the first and most important investigation is being conducted by French authorities. He says the probe into extremely serious allegations of sexual abuse of children by French soldiers in the Central African Republic was started last year on July 31st.
The allegations of what happened to these children are abhorrent. The details contained in interviews with alleged victims and witnesses by UN investigators, including one of our staff, last summer, are utterly odious.
The United Nations has a zero-tolerance policy for sexual abuse by its peacekeepers. It says the policy does not extend to the French force in CAR, which was not under the umbrella of the UN. 14 soldiers reportedly are charged with demanding sexual favors from young boys in return for food. They were part of a larger French peacekeeping force sent to the CAR to help restore order after fighting erupted in December 2013. Soldiers from Chad and Equatorial Guinea also are implicated. The French Ministry of Defense says the sexual abuse of around 10 children, one as young as 9, reportedly took place at a center for internally displaced people near the airport of the capital, Bangui, between December 2013 and June 2014. The abuse reportedly occurred before and after MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping mission in the CAR, was set up. The incidents became public when a senior UN official, Andres Compas, allegedly leaked a confidential UN report. Compas has been suspended with pay while an internal UN investigation is ongoing. Colville says the investigation is being carried out by the Office of Internal Oversight Services at the request of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad al-Hussein. Colville says the leak of the internal report may have breached strict rules that exist to protect victims, witnesses, and investigators.
Obviously, this is a matter of great importance, which is why such rules exist. Victims, witnesses, and investigators may be extremely vulnerable to reprisals, and we know of plenty of cases elsewhere where they've disappeared. The protection of sources must be of paramount importance, and I'm sure you understand this, especially when you have these young children involved. We know for a fact that at least one of the individuals named in this document has been contacted by a number of different media organizations within the last few days. This is very worrying.
Colville says implications that UN Human Rights Chief Zayd would try and cover up the sexual abuse of children is offensive and highly unlikely. He notes the High Commissioner is the author of the 2005 Zayd Report, which he says is the definitive UN report on sexual abuse in peacekeeping operations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dora Silia, a prominent member of the Zambian Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MMD, has announced her defection to the ruling Patriotic Front Party. She was the spokesperson of the party and would now contest as a parliamentary candidate of the ruling party. Chembe Nyangu is a founding member of the opposition MMD. He told me earlier that the party is suffering from poor leadership, which he said, if not corrected, could worsen the prospects of the MMD in the next election.
For Dora Silia to have defected to PF is because she resents the leadership of Dr. Nevas Mumba, which has been very dictatorial. She does not want to follow the laid-down procedures, the constitution. So basically, the Dora is actually trying to work with an NMD group, which helped President Lungu to win the election. She was one of the campaigners in Petauke for President Edgar Lungu to win that election. So I can only say that she has left the party, NMD party, because she does not want to associate herself with the President Nevas Mumba, who is at the helm of the party of NMD.
Do you think your party is in trouble based on even the performance of your presidential candidate in the last election?
Yes, the party is in trouble. As long as Dr. Mumba remains the leader of the party, nothing good will happen, because most of us who understand the party are not supporting. We didn't support. He was not even picked as our candidate. We had advised him that Dr. Mumba was not ready for the election. He was unprepared. He was unprepared. And that is how we approached President Rupiah Banda to come and stand that in the 20th general election, because President Banda was one of the leaders that we thought would be able to win an election. But Dr. Mumba, using his tricks, he went to court and abused the court to block the Rupiah Banda, and then the result is that he was humiliated badly to the extent that he can never win even a word election. So no. Dr. Mumba is actually one who is making NMD become unpopular.
But here is the case that some supporters of the party are blaming the leaders of the party, you inclusive, for bringing the former president to come and contest an election when it is against your own party constitution. So they blame you.
No. They don't understand the constitution. The constitution does not say who stands in the election. The one who stands in an election is one who will get adopted by the party main organ. Dr. Mumba was not picked by the party organ. He picked himself. He involved himself. That is how he lost. Terribly. He's the only candidate who was not adopted by his own party. He adopted himself.
What do you see as the way forward for your party? Because it seems your party is disintegrating.
The way forward for our party is to go to the convention and pick a leader who will be accepted, a leader who will inspire people to stay in the party. We have so many members out there who still want to hang into MMD because they don't feel like going in any other political party, because they feel that other political parties' manifestos and constitution do not live to their expectations. So MMD on the ground is still there. That's where you find all political parties are trying to entice members from MMD to join them, because they know that they're quite strong and effective where party mobilization is concerned. So all political parties are cannibalizing MMD because of the way we organized the party before Dr. Mumba came to the helm of the party.
What do you see as the performance of the MMD in the next election? Do you think the MMD can stand on its feet because of leadership crisis issues?
It will be very disastrous as long as Dr. Mumba will be the president of the party. It will be worse. If he got 15,000, this time he will get maybe 2,000. So the only way to salvage the party is to go to the convention, pick a leader who can inspire the members. Then MMD will be on the same footing with the other political parties. There is so much life in MMD if he's got a leader who inspires the membership. But with Dr. Mumba at the helm, forget. It will be very disastrous. Very extremely disastrous that that will be even much the worst performance of MMD if Dr. Mumba will insist to stand in 2016.
Chembe Nyangu is founding member of the Zambian Opposition Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, or MMD. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Plote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 3rd. The fight of the century has now been won and lost. American Floyd Mayweather Jr. won a 12-round unanimous decision against Filipino Manny Pacquiao on Saturday night, that is, early Sunday in Africa, in the richest fight in boxing history. In the fight, at the MGM Grand Arena in Las Vegas, United States, the three judges scored the fight 118-110, 116-112, and 116-112, all for Mayweather. Going into the fight, the 38-year-old Mayweather was the World Boxing Council and World Boxing Association welterweight champion, while Pacquiao was the World Boxing Organization welterweight champion. With the victory, the American becomes the unified welterweight champion. Mayweather remains undefeated as he improved his record to 48 wins with 26 knockouts. For his part, the record of 36-year-old Pacquiao fell to 57 wins, 6 losses and 2 draws with 39 knockouts. The 16,000-seat arena was packed full with celebrities, including Beyoncé and Jay-Z, Denzel Washington, Jamie Foxx, Robert De Niro, and Ben Affleck. Ringside tickets with face value of $10,000 apiece went for as high as $40,000 per one. The estimated $300 million in fight revenue is to be shared by Mayweather and Pacquiao 60-40, meaning that Mayweather could get as much as $180 million for the 36-minute fight. Before Saturday's fight, Mayweather had pocketed $420 million in his boxing career, compared with $335 million for Pacquiao. Well, Pacquiao has hinted that he lost the fight due to a shoulder injury. Pacquiao told a post-fight news conference that he had suffered the injury during training. 1 week before the fight, my shoulder wasn't 100%. We had an MRI, or magnetic resonance imaging, and there was a tear in my right shoulder, he said. The Filipino said he felt pain from the third round. I hesitated to be more aggressive because I only had one hand. My right was in pain. It is hard to fight with one hand, he said. According to the top boxing website fightnews.com, there had been some consideration given to postponing the fight due to the injury, but a decision was made not to reschedule. Reacting to the injury claim, Mayweather said, if he had won, I don't think he would have said that. Meanwhile, Mayweather has described Pacquiao as a tough competitor, saying, he's a true champion and we are both at our best tonight. The American said he will end his boxing career after his next fight in September. I'm almost 40 years old now. I've been in the sport for 19 years. I've been world champion for 18 years. And I'm really, truly thankful and blessed, he said. Turning to athletics, African runners won the men's and women's titles at the 2015 Prague Marathon today, Sunday. Kenyan Felix Kandi took his second marathon win in a row with another personal best in Prague, improving to 2 hours, 8 minutes and 32 seconds. Last November, Kandi set a course record of 2 hours, 10 minutes and 37 seconds at the Athens Marathon. Back to the Prague Marathon, fellow Kenyan Evans Chebet finished runner-up for the second year in succession with 2 hours, 8 minutes and 50 seconds, followed by Ethiopia's Deribe Robi, who finished in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 5 seconds. In the women's race, Yebrigwa Melese of Ethiopia clocked 2 hours, 23 minutes and 49 seconds to win. It was the third fastest winning time in the history of the race that started in 1995. As I reported earlier, Kenyan Felix Kandi took the men's title at the 2015 Prague Marathon, beating a strong field. After the race, the energetic Kandi Edwards spoke with Kandi,
We're talking with the winner of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon 2015, and that is Felix Candy. He's having a great last few months of the marathon. He won the tough Athens Marathon last November, set a course record, and here really beat a strong field. Felix, did you realise that you were in that kind of confident, strong shape when you came to Prague?
Yeah, when I came to Prague, I knew I had well preparation, as I was training well in Kenya, so I was expecting to do a marvelous job here. But as I arrived here, I felt a little bit sick. I had some flu. So since the other day, then last night, I was doubting. I say, maybe I'll try and run position 5 if it's worse, because I felt bad through the night. But I thank God, because during when I woke up in the morning, I felt a little bit better. And I say I'm going to try and push, maybe run a good position.
Well, you've run a personal best by around 2 minutes, or just under 2 minutes, and you beat Evans Chebet, who was second here last year. You make a habit of really attacking at the last stages of the race, around 33, 35K. I know that's always crucial in the marathon, but psychologically, do you feel strong at that point in the race?
Yeah, I feel stronger, especially from 30 kilometers. I usually feel strong, and I can push hard and maintain the constant pace that can lead me to a good position and a good time also.
Prague is not an easy course. It's got quite a lot of cobblestones, and it was quite warm out there today. Before that, you'd won Athens, which is also very tough. Are you a specialist for tough marathon courses?
Yeah, I'm actually well in running a tough marathons. As I used to also run in Kenya there. It's a high altitude and hilly, and I have won twice. In a strong field also, more than 500 Kenyans. So I knew that in tough courses, I usually do a good job.
Well, you're clearly a strong man. What about getting your time under 2 hours, 8 minutes? Is that the next objective, to run sub 2:08?
Yes, that was even my next objective, as I was saying maybe I could have run here also maybe 2:06, but due to my condition that changed the previous 2 days, so it led me to... didn't make it to run as I had planned.
Well, you certainly made a very speedy recovery from that virus and won the Volkswagen Prague Marathon. Felix Candy of Kenya, congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was the 2015 Prague Marathon winner, Felix Candy of Kenya, speaking with the energetic Andy Edwards. In African club football news, defending champion ES Setif of Algeria, Smouha of Egypt, and Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco have qualified for the lucrative group stage of the 2015 CAF Champions League. The teams qualified after their second round, second leg matches this weekend. ES Setif defeated Raja Casablanca of Morocco 4-1 on penalties after aggregate score deadlocked at 4-4. Raja won the first leg at home 2-2, but lost the advantage in the return leg after Setif won the game by the same scoreline, thus necessitating penalties to decide the winner. Also advancing is Smouha of Egypt, which won the return leg match against AC Leopards of Congo 2-0 to cancel out the 1-0 first leg win by the Congolese and advance 2-1 on aggregates. For his part, Maghreb Tetouan edged out Egyptian giant Al Ahly 4-3 on penalties after both teams deadlocked 1-1 on aggregates. Al Ahly won the return leg 1-0, nullifying the 1-0 first leg win by the Moroccans. 5 more teams will advance to the group stage after today's Sunday's matches, while the second round losers will enter into the parallel 2015 CAF Confederation Cup playoffs. The draw for the Champions League group stage will be held on Tuesday, May 5th. The 8 qualified teams will be drawn into 2 groups of 4, with each group being played on a home and away round robin basis. The winners and runners up in each group advance to the semi-finals. And in Africa's other club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, Warrior Wolves of Nigeria, Orlando Pirates of South Africa, as well as Tunisian clubs Etoile du Sahel and Club Africa are through to the playoff stage of the tournament. The teams qualified after securing aggregate victories against their opponents on the strength of their impressive outings in the second round return leg matches played this weekend. The Nigerian club scored a 1-0 victory against MK of the Democratic Republic of Congo to complete a 3-1 aggregate triumph. The lone goal in Kinshasa came on 72 minutes through Ogenekaro Etebo. Warrior Wolves officials and players dedicated the Kinshasa victory to outgoing governor of Nigeria's oil-rich Delta State, Emmanuel Uduagan. He bankrolled the trip to Central Africa for the cash-strapped club and also paid part of the team's salary arrears. In other matches, Orlando Pirates won 3-0 at home to CF Munana of Gabon to advance 5-2 on aggregates. Etoile emerged victorious 1-0 at home to Young Africans of Tanzania to advance 2-1 on aggregates, while Club Africain defeated Asoclef of Algeria 1-0 to qualify 2-1 on aggregates. The four qualified teams are joined by the three second-round losers so far from the CAF Champions League, that is Al Ahly of Egypt, AC Leopards of Congo, and Raja Casablanca of Morocco. Four more qualifiers will emerge after the second round return leg matches of the CAF Confederation Cup today, Sunday, while five more second-round losers from the Champions League will join the playoff, which will feature a total of 16 teams. At the draw for the playoff round to be held on Tuesday, the winners of the Confederation Cup second round will be drawn against the losers of the Champions League second round. Aggregate winners will advance to the group stage of the CAF Confederation Cup. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
And thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Why? Because I'm on the one sometimes I funk a kid on skin. I'm a danko. Let's go. Basita baya, basita baya, yarenga basita baya, basita baya. Found on a club center. I'm in the yere kwaigo. Yan de wuneng noye. Yan te wisen noye. Te wisen, te wisen. I go kalaba. I see girls with a gato. I see the body. I go wala for Lagos. Color I see. I don't have the people club. Where are the babies? Maybe they call me a hip hop. I say, see you for me. You got me. I mean, they see the top. I'm bad like you.
my sense to the gather the properties, eh? No time, no. Like a statue of liberty. Nobody knows tomorrow, so I'll be holding my destiny, yeah. As if he said, I don't go to the war. Some people, they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, the struggle, they double my hustle, hey. As if he said, I don't go to the war. Some people, they bubble, hey. I continue the struggle, they double my hustle, yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony, I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat, oh. Testimony, hey. My testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. My testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Je m'appelle Chop Money. Hey. It's good to be saving for rainy days. Cause you know it's easy. Yeah. Life is so delicate. Oh. Oh. So make una see me as evidence. Papa got mama confidence. Yes. His blessings are endless. So hey. As if he said, I don't go to the war. Some people they bubble. Hey. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. Hey. As if he said, I don't go to the war. Some people they bubble. Hey. I continue the struggle.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The president of Burundi seems determined to prolong his term in office despite the fact that there are strong opposition to the decision of his party to put him up as a candidate for the next presidential election. The argument made by the president and his supporters is that in his first term of 5 years, he was selected, not elected, and therefore they feel a second election now will give him the two-term election, which is provided for in the Arusha Agreement, which brought much stability to Burundi after many years of turmoil, and also not violating the constitution of Burundi. What the president of Burundi does not seem to understand is what happened recently in Burkina Faso, where President Blaise Compaoré was kicked out of office by the people when he tried to make changes to prolong his own rule. It is also true that in his region, there are presidents who do not believe in the limitation of term of office. Museveni of Uganda and Bashir of the Sudan, who has just been elected despite opposition boycott. But the principle of limitation has a democratic purpose. He doesn't mean that the people may not want to elect a good president. When you take into account the situation in the United States, President Franklin Roosevelt was much beloved by the American people. He had been elected for third term, and he could have been elected for many more terms in office. And mind you, the term of office for the president is 4 years for any term. So he could have gone on and on. But there was this cry of never again. And there was a constitution amendment which limited the term of office of any president to 2 terms, which means total of 8 years. Burundian president has already will be serving for 10 years, and he is now contemplating serving another 5 years, which will mean 15 years as president. Now, the regional powers have been watching the situation. the African Union has taken the decision that it would not interfere and the matter should be resolved within the context of Burundi. But already we have outflows of refugees from Burundi to neighboring countries, thereby creating the condition for instability in the Great Lakes region. The United States government has taken a firm position, making it clear that it would be better and practical if the Burundian president did not contest the election for another 5 years. Now, within Burundi, there is no abating of the opposition. Opposition leaders have been arrested, the university has been closed, and there is no end in sight of the turmoil. What is required at this stage would be for the president to act in a very noble manner and to declare that while he welcomed the decision of his party to put him up as a candidate, he could not serve or accept it because of the instability in the country. If he should do that, he will match the wise decision recently displayed by President Goodluck Jonathan in Nigeria, who, prior to the announcement of the final results, declared his acceptance of the result and accept his defeat, something which has been widely welcomed not only in Africa, but in the international community. Should the president of Burundi do that, it will begin to show that there is growing maturity of the political class in Africa and thereby enhance stability throughout the continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, wealth, if you use it, comes to an end. Learning, if you use it, increases. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the run-up to World Press Freedom Day, the Department of State highlighted the cases of several journalists around the world who are being silenced because they exercise their fundamental right to free expression and spoke truth to power. From Syria, the State Department cited the imprisonment of three important human rights and free expression activists who remain imprisoned by the brutal regime of President Bashar al-Assad, Mazen Darwish, Hana Zitani, and Hussein Kargir. Mazen Darwish is the director of the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression, a non-governmental organization he founded that specializes in promoting freedom of expression and that also played a key role in disseminating information about daily developments in Syria, including the atrocities committed by the Assad regime. Mr. Darwish and his two colleagues were arrested at their office by regime security forces in February 2012. The three men were held for 2 years without charge and an additional year without trial after charges were filed. Their trial on the spurious charge of promoting terrorist acts has been postponed 22 times. The prison conditions in Syria are abominable, with torture and abuse rampant in regime-run detention centers, as has been well documented, including by the 55,000 photographs smuggled out of the country in 2013 by a former Syrian army photographer who goes by the alias Caesar. U.S. State Department Acting Spokesperson Marie Harf called for the immediate release of Mazen Darwish, Hani Sitani, and Hussein Gharir, arrested and detained for exercising their human rights. She also called on the Assad regime to release all arbitrarily detained journalists and political prisoners who are currently suffering horrific conditions and are at risk of abuse and torture in the prisons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.